We officially have destroyed environmental FUD. And that took like 3 years of data intensive, systematic, cooperative Bitcoiners like coming together and shitting on that FUD. But with like the quantum stuff, we kind of FUD ourselves. So we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot a bit. Okay, well, I feel pretty confident Bitcoin's going to take the market of gold. Like it has all these properties that are just so much better. A lot of people have probably been rotating out of Bitcoin into other assets. And that eventually there's going to be some sort of rotation back into Bitcoin. That's what we think can really start to spike things sometime this year. And there's plenty of room within just that specific market of rotation to move Bitcoin's price, you know, to 100,000 and beyond. Bitcoin's gradual now. And gradual is what leads to a suddenly moment. Over the next few years, we'll look back on 2026 and be like, okay, that's when it started.
Nostr is interesting because it's one of those things where I think that a lot of people just purely aren't going to end up using it until they really need to.
Yeah.
Or they're going to use it without realizing they're using it. Like that's what we're seeing with BitChat right now, where it's like Nostr is on the back end of BitChat to enable like the non-local side of the comms. And like, you know, BitChat's got like a million monthly active users right now, which is wild.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's a sign of the times, right? Like, you have to wonder, like, did Jack, like, so Jack built it, then Callie ported it over to Android. But, like, you have to wonder, like, Jack clearly saw the writing on the wall. Like, it's been insane to see that kind of, like, rapid adoption for that. Just for a totally free, not harvesting your data app. Like, it's kind of like it's a beautiful thing, really.
No, it's amazing. And, like, a few points on that. I hit on this point in our annual report when I'm talking about different forms of adoption and, you know, where eCash could have like a strong distribution channel through something like that's a it's a great platform for it. In our like protocol section of the report, like that's one of the key takeaways that we put out. And like one of the things that I think a lot of the, you know, more either like well-intentioned technologists of the crypto world believed in of like this fat protocol thesis where you're going to have a token and it's going to earn fees because people need the gas to use your infrastructure. And, you know, Chris Dixon, the partner at A16Z kind of, you know, pushed out like the read, write, own thesis around a lot of that. And it's like, we're not seeing that happening. And now the data is kind of on our side. And, you know, Bitcoiners for a long time just assume this intuitively because we think from a very different perspective about the industry. And it just seemed like some extra layer of intermediation to have some new token. It's like, why use a new token? Why not use money? And they're just like forcing you into an alternative form of money that you otherwise would not use in the same way that like, you know, airlines do that too with points and all these companies that do it with points. It's like, okay, so at best, maybe these things are like point systems. But you can really only do that if you're like an oligopoly and crypto is just like too commoditized. So we've seen like this race to the bottom in terms of like people using the other crypto blockchains for settlement of different applications. And what everybody's realizing now is, oh, wait, it's really like the applications that matter and nobody really cares about what blockchain it's on and, you know, whatever is like cheapest in terms of fees and nobody gives a shit about any of that. And if you have a good application that needs it as infrastructure for whatever reason, then that's what we're going to see. And like, that's a key point that we try to make to a lot of technical founders is that in a variety of ways of like, nobody really gives a shit about the infrastructure. You need to make applications that are leveraging your infrastructure in some sort of novel way. And that's what's going to attract the users. And that's what BitChat was. And that's a huge form of adoption for Nostr's infrastructure. And that's a really good thing. And so many things come at the app layer and like so much of the value is coming at the app layer. And it's like, if we want to get that, if you want to have like other Bitcoin layers be used, then we need to have applications that are using it in a novel way that are going to attract people without even knowing like, oh, this was the Lightning Network or we used Arc or we used something else. But yeah, we wrote about BitChat and that form of adoption. And that was one thing that surprised me as well. It was funny because like I remember when it was first popping up, I love how much the human rights use case for it has made it go viral and take off. Because when it was first popping up, I was like, oh, like what's the most obvious reason that I could see in like, you know, at least more developed economies for people to want to hop on a Bluetooth mesh network and connect with a bunch of people locally? It's like finding drugs at concerts. I was like, that would be a very viral use case for something like BitChat. And I expect that that'll probably still happen, but I love that it's not making its foray into something that's more like, you know, socially critical and into something that's like very socially defensible for why an application that provides freedom technology for people, you know, is needed around the world in a very serious way.
No, I mean, first of all, well said. And I think it is, it's an interesting kind of larger point here. And this is, I was talking with David Marcus from Lightspark, I think right before the kind of holiday break there. And that was one of the things that he was really focused on was like, and that's, I mean, as you know, you mentioned it, you know, that's really what they're doing over there is trying to figure out, okay, like we're thinking of Bitcoin and Bitcoin layer two networks as rails versus thinking about like, we just want to make stuff that people like, it works better because it's using better technology. It's using technology on top of Bitcoin versus, hey, like we need people to quote adopt Bitcoin. It's like, they're going to adopt it, whether they like it or not, they're going to adopt it just because we're using the rails behind the scenes. They don't even know about it, but it's just a better experience with lower fees or faster settlements or whatever it is. And I think this is just a really interesting point to be at because so much of the focus on Bitcoin is on just, at least in the Western world, is on the store of value side of things, right? Is on, you know, just protect, like looking at it as just an investable asset. There's a lot less focus in the Western world, again, not so much in the global South, on the medium of exchange side of things or on the payment rails side of things. But like these developments are happening. They're very much happening. I just feel like a lot of people really aren't paying attention to it. Is that kind of what your vibe is as well?
Yeah. And so much of it comes down to like, what sources are you following? What part of the media is it coming through? But like these types of concepts, I agree, they really only come through in like the technical community. And that was another big thing that we hit on in the report. We had this whole section called Bitcoin Media. And we did that with Fernando, who's running marketing at Blockstream formerly. And now he has this new website called Perception that's really, really cool. And he's just doing a ton of meta analysis on like every form of Bitcoin attention that exists and what it's like across different media channels and how can we think and like have creative ideas around that. And like in the report, we hit in how massive the gap is between like the Bitcoiner demographic who goes to Bitcoin conferences and listens to Bitcoin podcasts and what their current perception is of Bitcoin based on that versus like some investor in New York who reads about Bitcoin through like a BlackRock blog post or through general financial media and what their current perception of Bitcoin is. And there's like this massive gap between people's perceptions based off of that. So like in the media section, when we're getting into a lot of these things, that's like one of the narratives that we pulled out of it for the technical community is when people talk about like layer two, or Lightning, it's like, that's just like this huge GTM trap. Nobody knows what that means. Nobody cares what that means. If you're talking in those terms, your market of visibility is the technical community. And that's not what's going to, you know, build your app for you. You need to be reaching out to general consumers that, or, you know, institutions that are actually using this. And that's kind of the problem is because a lot of thinking around these things has originated from us building the infrastructure. Everybody still holds that frame of talking about it from the point of view of the infrastructure. And I feel like we're going through a shift where the market's forcing everybody to realize, well, here's what we actually care about. And don't talk about things in terms of like what your infrastructure you're using. You know, nobody says like, no guy is downloading Instagram because he wants to use HTTPS. And like, you know, and that sounds ridiculous to us now because now we have this whole app layer built out and we know exactly why. A guy downloads Instagram probably because he wants to scroll through like cars and boobs and stuff. And like, that's the consumer motivation that you're looking at. And that needs to be applied more to Bitcoin companies, just really thinking from that framework. And yeah, I definitely agree with David's perspective on a lot of this because he brings kind of like the broader like tech learnings and culture into our industry. And I think that's valuable.
Yeah, you know, so I was thinking about the best way to structure this conversation, just because I think there's so much stuff in this report to be able to cover. And I was kind of wondering, you let me know what you think on this, but I almost want to go through kind of some of the predictions that you guys put forward in the report and use that as kind of the jumping off point for us in the larger conversations. Cause they're like, it's a really, I like that you started out the report with that. It's like a nice way to kind of, okay, the TLDR here, here's what we think is going to happen. Now you can get into the meat and potatoes of what that actually means.
Yeah.
First of all, for people who want to maybe download the report and read along, if they're listening to this, where should they find this to be able to download it?
Yeah, it's just on our website, epochvc.io. So that's epochvc.io. You go to the writing section in there. It's the one at the top.
Okay, awesome. So yeah, if that sounds good with you, let's start there, because the very first line in that prediction section has a nice little, you know, kind of tongue in cheek joke in it too for Bitcoiners. But the price of Bitcoin reaches at least 150,000 Federal Reserve notes, backed by the full faith and declining credit of the U.S. government. So starting off with the price prediction, bold. This is, you know, 2026 predictions overall. There's quite a wide swath of them. But let's talk about that from a vibes perspective, because a lot of people right now seem to think they're watching gold run, they're watching silver run. And I think people have two different reactions to this. One is like me, I'm saying, boy, can you believe how many people are piling into gold and silver at what is going to probably be a local top? And, you know, wow, shocking. And the other people saying, boy, I'm about to pile into gold and silver because look, Bitcoin's not doing anything. What's your read on this? 150K, I'd say it's almost doubling from here. But that puts you, it's a pretty, like, it's conservative to strong in terms of the prediction. How did you guys arrive at that?
So what's helpful is for me to give the audience like context on my framework of thinking around this. And, you know, coming from like the traditional finance world, you know, there's like the saying that, you know, the only certainty you get from using any sort of model is that it's wrong. And that's the case for like any sort of, you know, financial prediction about the future. In most things in traditional finance that are often viewed by people as a form of science, like very fundamental forms of modeling, like capital asset pricing model or discounted cash flow valuations and all these different tools that are used by Wall Street guys to determine like what the fundamental value of some sort of asset is worth. They're just an aggregation of a ton of assumptions about the future. And it really like brings, and I think what like the Bitcoin community is called into question about a lot of things when we have these new assets trading that have been so heavily criticized over the years, it calls these models that are viewed as a science into question, because for the first time we have new, very novel assets to now value. And then the question becomes, well, what really is speculative when people would, you know, criticize Bitcoin as being a speculative asset? It's like, well, what is speculative? And speculative, I think, really means in like modern parlance to people, what they're intending it to mean is it has a lot of speculation in it by some, you know, arbitrary consideration. Like we know that if a company has been producing a significant amount of cash flow for decades on end, I'm much more certain that they'll do it again next year than a company that's never done it before. And so like one might actually still produce the same amount of cash flow in a year as like a startup and it'll blow up. But it's hard based on the historical precedent to like look at that. And I think that like that type of framing of like what truly is something speculative is, I think it's important to understand, because in Bitcoin, when I was first introduced to it, I took my background in finance with my, you know, undergraduate education. I was a CFA charter holder, so I got, you know, deepest into this. And then on top of that, you know, with kind of like the deepest financial education outside of like going into like PhDs or something that don't really matter in finance. But when I viewed something like Bitcoin, it's I had this large background in my prior job in like valuation, like valuing really esoteric things for like you're in like a litigation or something. And you need to say in front of like a judge in a court, this is what the value of it is. And that's like very precise and technical based on like the very precise technical theory. And I had a lot of experience with that. And when I would think through all of that and I first heard about Bitcoin, like my first reaction wasn't like, oh, I hate Bitcoin, this thing's stupid. I didn't understand it because it was pitched to me as like a blockchain technology. And I was just like, I don't know, it's a speculative investment. Like it doesn't produce cash flow. That's not the type of investing I do. I don't know how to, you know, come up with a framework of assessing what it's actually worth and then whether or not it's over or undervalued. And that caused me to like write Bitcoin off for years. And what gave me a good framework for doing that is really, I think it's, well, you need to get deep into understanding the fundamental characteristics of Bitcoin. And when you do that, and when you understand, here are the fundamental properties that make it good. It is scarce. It is, you know, highly portable. It's highly divisible. It's all these different monetary properties that make something a good money. And when you get deep into that, you realize, okay, well, what is the size of the market of money? And then we've had a bunch of people in the industry put out different versions of what those sizes are. And if it, you know, consumes the market of gold, if it consumes the market of, you know, real estate to some percentage, if it starts to take a lot of share from stocks and bonds, you know, we can get into these really, really big numbers. And all of a sudden, the numbers just become so big when you think about it, that it's not even worth talking about. You know, it's just like me deciding whether it's worth 80 trillion or 200 trillion really doesn't make a difference from here. All that tells you is buy it and hold it for a long time until that happens. And that's, once you get to that framework of thinking, which is like, for like the, you know, more technical crowd, that's a top-down analysis. Like, you take a top-down perspective of what's the total size. Let's think through these little details. Okay, we can get down to like a smaller version of that, of like, okay, well, I feel pretty confident Bitcoin's going to take the market of gold. Like, it has all these properties that are just so much better. Sure, there's some segments of the gold market that are distinct from Bitcoin. They are used in like electronics or for some sort of utility, or it's used in jewelry, you know, and there's it's not going to take all of gold, but it's going to take some very large percentage of the monetary premium of gold, of people holding gold simply because it's scarce and they think it'll go up. And, so that's like a pretty easy bet to make. And it's just like, okay, let's make that. Okay, what are we looking at now on that? We're looking at like a, what is that? Like a, you know, 10, 20X here. I don't even know. Now that gold's across 5,000.
Yeah, right.
It's way up there. So it's like, cool. 10, 20X just to take the market of gold. And then there's a lot more to run after that. Easy decision. So that's the fundamental framework. That's how I think about Bitcoin. And then what a lot of people in the community do is they'll, you know, create these models where they say it must follow some sort of law. And we've, you know, been through different versions of this over time. We had stock to flow model, and then people watch that break. And then, you know, people look at power law distributions. And it's not to say that there isn't like some sort of truth or indication towards it. But I think a lot of people start to view these things as like a causal model. And it's just like, no, Bitcoin has like some characteristic that is tied to this variable, and it's probably tracked it to a degree because of that. And if enough people start to believe that for a period of time, then it starts to become this self-fulfilling prophecy. And then eventually that breaks. Like, you watch, that's like Robert Shiller wrote this book, who's like a Nobel Prize winning PhD type economist guy. And narrative economics. And you kind of go into that of like narratives, you kind of get this like fun time in the sun with a narrative. And then eventually it will break once it starts to become circular and people are aware that it's like this narrative. And that's kind of how I think about it with a lot of these models. So like in the report, to like tie all that back to this, you know, question of how did we get to this prediction? Like I never like believed in, we have these like 4-year cycles that are just going to continue. At best, it's a self-fulfilling narrative, and eventually that's going to break at some point. So we could say either it was at one end of the spectrum, spurious correlation. It was just completely by chance that it started to follow halving cycles with its price. And like, if you go to this website that we have flagged in the report, it's like spuriouscorrelations.com. It's a really funny website to go to. You can look at all the different spurious correlations that exist in the world, and you wouldn't believe how many things very closely track completely unrelated variables. So like, that's one end of the spectrum of thinking. And then I think at the other end of the spectrum, it's like, okay, maybe there was a self-fulfilling prophecy in the narrative, and then, well, okay, that's broken now. So whether it's cycles never happened or cycles are officially broken, like the way that we're thinking about it now is we're going to have this macro backdrop that's always going to be impacting things. There's, you know, Luke Roman's making a case for certain like legitimate variables that could have happened. It's not something that I view as primarily causal, despite the historical liquidity correlation. And like the reason I'll explain that is kind of based on our second prediction in the report after this 150,000 price prediction. And that said, you know, we predict that like we'll look back on 2026 and say that was probably the year that Bitcoin started decoupling from either, you know, you could think about it as its correlation with liquidity or just like equities in general, how most people think about it, and risk assets broadly. So that won't be obvious because it takes time, but sometime around like 2027, 2028, I think we'll end up looking back and be like, okay, 2026 was the year that that happened. And like the short version in the report is, I think that we have this shift happening right now, or that we've seen building over the years in, you know, commodity adoption. And we've had a variety of short-term forces that have been negatively impacting the price of Bitcoin. It's too hard to attribute what came when. But when you look at just how much like mean reversion can ultimately happen, how much like the analogy said in the industry is Bitcoin's a, it's like a ball that's with air in it held, or like a balloon underwater, you know, like, yeah, it's eventually going to return to a certain balance. If you kind of look at Bitcoin denominated in gold, that story starts to look pretty clear. And it looks like we've just been in a bear market for a period of time. And that the reality is if you believe in like some sort of cycle coming out of this, you know, we're getting close to about like 400 days on this bear market. And it when Bitcoin's denominated in gold, and that if you look at the historical cycles, it starts going up a lot after that. It's not really the way I think about it. Like, people want to look at it directly on a chart like that, but I think about it from the perspective of commodities are getting a very strong allocation. Bitcoin has these fundamental properties. A lot of people have probably been rotating out of Bitcoin into other assets because of this. And that eventually there's going to be some sort of rotation back into Bitcoin as they start to view those as maturing, or they've, you know, reached the top of their run, or they start to say like, okay, we want to take a little bit of money off the table and start to reallocate as like an institution. So like, I think like the gold rotation is going to be one of the first dominoes where it's like gold's flying past 5,000 right now. There's going to be a lot of people that look and they say like, everybody's going to be asking this question, why is Bitcoin still down when we see the case of commodities increasing so significantly and becoming so strong? And we have over a decade worth of data to look at that structural shift. Like, we know that this is a persistent trend in markets at this point. So that'll be like the first shift. And like, I think that that's what we think can really start to spike things sometime this year. And there's plenty of room within just that specific market or rotation to move Bitcoin's price, you know, to 150,000 and beyond. And then what we do after that is we go into, okay, what are like these pools of capital that are large and exist around the world that are also able to flow into Bitcoin for a specific reason like that? So we, you know, we go into ETF flows, we go into nation state adoption, we go into wealth management firms, we go into, you know, broader asset management firms, and we look at if they had certain percentages of allocation that started moving into it, what do those numbers look like? And to the point I was making earlier about the market sizing of Bitcoin, the numbers are so large that it doesn't really merit discussion. Like, these things are big and people like to see them in charts. Here you go, here's a chart. And I think that tying all that together, it's like, okay, so what is like the fundamental characteristic that starts to make that happen? And the key thing we call out in the report is Bitcoin's declining volatility. That's this very persistent trend where we can witness it continuing to decline. And we're at a point now where, you know, Bitcoin is less volatile than some of these major equities that a lot of people own, you know, like Nvidia and Tesla. And like, we have this chart kind of laying that out of how, you know, the 2025 volatility of Bitcoin was much less than those, even despite its poor price performance during that period. And, you know, and it's owned by like 12% of people within the US, we're estimating. And like, and then you look at these other stocks and it's like, that's like, that stock ownership is closer to like 60%. Within the US. And it's like, okay, so people all think, like, if you were to ask anybody, like, you would ask very serious institutional investors, is Bitcoin riskier than Nvidia stock? And they'll be like, yes. Like, you know, they'll far and away believe that. And there's kind of like this perception gap where I think the data is changing and Bitcoin's volatility is lowering and it's actually starting to become a bit more of like a safer asset than it once was, from just like a pure volatility standpoint. There's a bunch of other for people listening that want to, you know, give me a gotcha, like there's a million other reasons why like Bitcoin can't go bankrupt. So it's actually way safer than companies that can go bankrupt. But putting all that aside, just looking at the volatility of its price, I think that that shift will start to change things. So what does that mean? That means once people start to correctly assess the risk profile of Bitcoin as an asset, that that's when I think that decoupling moment starts to happen. And I think we're going to see a lot lower volatility. So this is the narrative in the report. We say Bitcoin's gradual now. And gradual is what leads to a suddenly moment. Like that's the thing. Bitcoin's price getting boring is exactly what sets it up for people to say, oh shit, Bitcoin's really boring now. Its volatility is a lot lower. And well, we should be allocating more of our portfolios to this. And you look at the sizes of these pools of capital where a nation state says, you know, if you're a nation state and you say, why do I want to have gold over Bitcoin? It's because it's got, you know, the capital markets for gold are the deepest in the world outside of like, you know, treasury denominated assets. And so if I want to go move $200 billion, I can feel very confident that like moving that in like a gold structured product of some sort is not going to move the market. Whereas you go try to move $200 billion in Bitcoin today, you know, we're talking about 10% of the market capitalization on that move. So that makes it a lot less attractive to these guys to put it in. And so lowering the volatility of it, I think is something that actually comes from it just simply gradually growing over time, having lower volatility, saying, okay, this is a bit safer. It starts to get bigger. Okay, now we're not going to move the market as much. And this is something that can actually serve as more of an alternative of gold to like large sizes of money. And that's like the inflection point, I think. Like, I think if Bitcoin gradually grinds up, say, 2 to 4x, and we get into the like, you know, 150,000, 250,000 range, now we're talking about a capital pool that the addressable market for people who own gold has just probably not just doubled, but because it's a long tail, like the market of like who owns gold. It's like the biggest guys own vast majority of it. But, you know, quantity wise, most people own much smaller amounts of gold, most nation states, et cetera. So when you double the liquidity of Bitcoin, now there's a bunch of people who are like expecting, oh, well, I want to sell 10 billion or 20 billion. When Bitcoin was a $2 trillion asset, that didn't make sense. Now that it's a $5 trillion asset, it's starting to make a little bit more sense. So I think that there's like multiples in the market size that it can actually increase that are like now addressable for it as a reserve asset. And that's what leads to this like decorrelation and decoupling and like a suddenly moment over time. So like that's kind of our prediction. And we kind of see like, we see it moving up in 2026 and it's probably just going to be like a boring gradual, like it just starts to continue to move up. Maybe it hits that inflection point then. But I think that whenever it does hit its suddenly moment over the next few years, that we'll look back on 2026 and be like, okay, that's when it started. And it was because it was so boring that it actually started to make sense for a lot more people to put money into it.
Wish you could access cash without selling your Bitcoin? Ledin makes that possible. The global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending, Ledin has issued over $10 billion in loans since 2018 and has a perfect record of protecting client assets. Why is a Ledin loan different? Well, with custodied loans, collateral is not lent out to generate interest. No credit checks, no monthly payments. Apply in minutes and repay whenever you want, with zero penalties. And proof of reserves reports verified by a top accounting firm are published every 6 months. Ledin gives Bitcoin holders a secure, transparent way to unlock liquidity without selling. Learn more at ledin.io/walker. That's ledin.io/walker. If you're hodling Bitcoin personally or for a business, here's the uncomfortable truth. You probably don't have insurance. Most policies exclude Bitcoin, and the ones that don't, they only pay you back in fiat. What's the point of that if you need to claim a loss when number go up? That's not insurance, that's liquidation. Now there's another option, BDIC. They're building an insurance marketplace on the Bitcoin standard. One Bitcoin lost equals one Bitcoin paid. They've integrated with Liana Business for enterprise self-custody with personal wallet coverage options coming later this year. If you care about protecting your Bitcoin as Bitcoin, sign up for the waitlist at BDIC.io /walker. That's bdic.io/walker. Insurance on the Bitcoin standard. Blockstream Jade Plus delivers robust security with fully open source hardware and software. Its unique genuine check feature ensures your device is authentic, giving you ultimate peace of mind. With versatile connectivity options, including Bluetooth, USB-C, built-in camera, and SD card, Jade Plus offers unparalleled flexibility in managing your Bitcoin. Whether you prefer wireless convenience or air-gapped security, Jade has you covered. Its innovative design features a durable metal case, a bright 1.9-inch color screen, and intuitive navigation buttons that make managing your Bitcoin straightforward and enjoyable. Jade Plus also supports secure, air-gapped transactions via QR code signing using the Jade Link storage device, keeping your Bitcoin safe without compromising convenience. Visit store.blockstream.com and use my coupon code WALKER for an exclusive 10% discount on your Blockstream Jade Plus. Protect your Bitcoin, sleep better, stack harder. Okay, so, and I appreciate that background. So to make sure I understand this, you're actually saying basically like the gradually leads to the suddenly. You're not necessarily saying that Bitcoin is going to have diminishing returns in the long run, more so that its volatility has been decreased to a point now where it looks like, quote, stable, right, to a lot of investors, and that in fact then leads to, okay, it actually has incredible upside potential because now more capital is flowing into it, because more capital feels comfortable flowing into it, the liquidity increases in the total market, and that sort of is just this self-perpetuating cycle that eventually just leads to like that suddenly moment. Is that fair to say? And so you're not on the diminishing returns thesis, you're just saying it may look like that in the short term. And then you get that point where it's that inflection point. Is that, am I understanding correctly?
Yeah. I think that's right. It's like, I think Bitcoin's having diminishing returns within the current perception of it. Of like, if you think of the entire universe of investors that are focused on Bitcoin today, which is a very small percentage of the total like investor world, within that, it's having diminishing returns. By becoming more gradual, becoming more boring, and having more like stability in price, then it starts to open up what other like investors are looking at it and why. And maybe not even the investor themselves, but what bucket they're putting it into. Because like so much of this is driven by narrative. Like you go to an asset management summit or you go talk with family offices and you learn how a lot of these investors are thinking. It's just the reality is nobody has time to know everything. And most of what they're doing is they're listening to narratives that they hear in different places. And the second, a bunch of data, we have like a consistent amount of data that says like, well, look at Bitcoin. It's starting to, its volatility is significantly lower. It's, you know, up 100%, 150% over the past year or two. $3 trillion market cap asset. If people were just like, oh, interesting, is this thing a risk hedge? I mean, the second Bitcoin is viewed as a risk off asset, like truly, that's when I think things really start to change. And that's when a lot of people are like, well, we should at least put like 2% into something like this, because that's what we do with gold. And Bitcoin's probably just like a higher return version of gold.
So that kind of brings us into the next couple of points here, which is point number three. Is Bitcoin rises at least 50% in gold terms from a Bitcoin rotation trade? And then the next one is a major asset manager adds a 2% allocation to Bitcoin in its model portfolio. So do you think those kind of go, I mean, do they go hand in hand a little bit where it's like people start to realize as Bitcoin catches a bid, like, does the Bitcoin price movement versus gold, do you kind of see gold moving a bit stagnant? Like, do you think this is as high as gold goes for a while and then it kind of levels out, Bitcoin starts doing the moving? And then people realize, there's a rotation, again, like self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like rotation trade is happening. We should get in on this. We should add this to our model portfolio because we've seen what it's done in other model portfolios. You know, if you added just like a 1-5% allocation over 5 years, like it helps your portfolio drastically. Is that kind of how you see that playing out?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, I think gold's going up. I think gold is a good asset for the reasons that I just described, and people are going to continue to view it that way. I just think that there, if you like, when you view a market from the perspective of there's a market is the aggregation of, you know, millions of different perspectives, when you view it from that perspective, it's like, okay, so with any market, with any owner of something, there's some marginal group. There's some group that's like right on the edge of that market. And they're like, yeah, we own this, but like, if Bitcoin was just, you know, a little bit bigger or a little bit less volatile, we would shift out of it. You know, when you think about it from that perspective, there's some marginal group of sellers that could move out of one market and into another. That's kind of how we're viewing it. And to your point on like the model portfolios, like we put this chart in there that's showing the market sizing of some of that. And it's like, if you look at, some of these like major large wealth management firms, Morgan Stanley and the like, they have like a range of recommendation around Bitcoin allocations. It kind of varies across all of them. And we put this chart that says, if you took all the low ones and then you took all the high ones for each one, here's kind of based on how much they're managing, what that would look like across their client groups and how much would flow into it. And like, even on like the low allocation, it's like 400 billion. So we're talking about multiples greater than like ETF AUM. And that's just a recommendation. But if some of these large firms put it into what's like structurally a model portfolio where they say like, you're a new client onboarding, here's where we're going to start you off with in this structured portfolio. It's like the default template. And then based on what we talked to you about, you know, we'll finagle what we actually want to do with it. And so like, I think having that shift of like Bitcoin moving from just recommendations within these firms to being in like a modern portfolio, that's going to be a very major shift. And like the capital size of that's massive.
No. I mean, it like when you look at the actual amount of money that is sloshing around out there, like Bitcoin's now under $2 trillion market cap starts to look comically small when you also understand what Bitcoin is. Like it's, and to me, Eric, where I'm at with this right now is that, and this is like a drum I've been beating, is just that it seems that there's a huge information asymmetry right now. For those that get their 40 hours per week of Bitcoin podcasts and are paying attention and are in the know, you know, and have been following this closely, maybe you're a little bit disappointed by Bitcoin's price action right now, especially when you watch the gold bugs and the silver simps dancing on Bitcoin's grave. But at the same time, the fact that that is happening and the fact that Bitcoin is kind of languishing right now a little bit in this, you know, 90 to 100K zone, to me, that just signals that like, wow, we are still so crazy early because the vast, vast majority of people have no idea what we're talking about here. They have no idea because if they did, they'd be piling into Bitcoin, but they're not, so they don't. And so to me, this just seems like, you know, whether you're a managing a ton of money or you're just a pleb stacking for yourself and your family, to me, this just feels like one of those opportunities that you're going to look back on in 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and you're going to be like, wow, either thank God I was stacking like a psychopath or dang, I wish I would have been stacking like a psychopath.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, you think about, I remember in like the depths of the last bear market and when we were getting close to like 20 to 15K, and that was like really the first time when I was just like gung ho, like, yeah, like, thank God it's this low. I can't even believe it's this low. And then you look back on that and it's just like, thank God I, you know, put my money into Bitcoin at that point in time. That was huge. That impacted my life significantly. And yeah, I don't think it's that long until we're just like, remember Bitcoin at 90K? Like that, those were fun times.
No, it's true. And I want to get into a couple of these other points too, because the next two are kind of related. And it's around treasury companies, which have been a, let's say, contentious topic. So the first part here, point number five, is about Metaplanet achieving its highest MNAV among other Bitcoin treasury companies. And you're going to say market cap greater than a billion. And then after that, an activist investor or competitor liquidating a Bitcoin treasury company, capturing the spread between its MNAV discount and the value of its Bitcoin. So can we talk about that a little bit? Because the first point around Metaplanet, I think, is interesting. The second point is perhaps even more so because it's been one that people have been kind of theorizing about a lot. Like, okay, now that these companies are trading at a discount to MNAV, wouldn't it make sense to somehow, be able to extract that Bitcoin from there that you're basically getting on sale? So how are you guys thinking about this? What, maybe we can start in the Metaplanet point and then kind of get into the larger, like, hey, which company's getting, or maybe not which, but why would a company get liquidated at this stage?
Yeah. So we had the, I think the quickest way to describe the Metaplanet one is just Metaplanet is the only Bitcoin treasury company right now that has like an operating income. When you think about like the pure play Bitcoin treasury companies, All of the other ones have expenses because they're paying people. Strategy does too. Strategy, it's so big that its expenses are like a very small percentage, you know, a few basis points of, you know, the amount of Bitcoin they have every year. But Metaplanet's been consistently applying a strategy that actually earns like a direct Bitcoin yield on their stack. And they're doing different derivative strategies and things to do that. And they're generating a large amount of income from it. So that offsets the cost of all the people they're paying to run it. And not only that, it actually grows the amount of Bitcoin that exists. And it's the only one doing that. Some of the other ones like Nakamoto
besides
and Strive.
Strategy, like, right?
Well, strategy is not generating like a direct yield. Yeah, like strategy is not like... like they're not selling like covered calls on their Bitcoin stack or anything like
okay.
that.
Okay, they do have their obviously they're still operating business like in the traditional sense though. Where they
I see what you're saying. Yeah. And I would presume I haven't looked at that number, but I would presume that their operating business income would still probably not offset these costs. But I could be wrong about that because the operating business is like so small within the company that it doesn't really move the needle. But maybe it does. I'm not sure. But I guess like, so of like the pure play characteristics though, earning a Bitcoin yield is what Metaplanet did. And not only that, but if you look at like who started with X amount of Bitcoin and then how much they grew it over the past year, like Strategy, you know, on an absolute basis, obviously got the most Bitcoin. But like Metaplanet on a relative basis year over year grew its Bitcoin stack so significantly. So like they just crushed 2025. And I think that it's like if you're running a pure play treasury company, there's just like a lot of things that they've got going for them that make sense with like the tax environment, et cetera. It's like, okay, I see the model making sense here. They're offsetting their operating income. Some of these other treasury companies like Naka and Strive are spending like a ton of money and their operating costs are really cutting into the Bitcoin. So we'll see if that changes. We'll see what happens. You know, I'm sure that they have a ton of different plans, but we're like, okay, Metaplanet's kind of crushing it. They're doing a good job with that.
So then I guess the next question there would be, and I appreciate the explanation. The next question would be just around a company getting liquidated by either activist investors or a competitor. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So like, the theory, there's a difference between like, as an investor of any strategy between like what theoretically makes sense on paper and then what you can actually execute in a market. And that's because markets are dynamic. They change based on new information at, you know, any point in time. So if like an activist investor, for example, they want to be really quiet about what they're doing until it's time for them to do it because they don't want to start signaling markets and doing different things that are going to change it. So if, for example, an active investor wanted to get a position in a treasury company and accumulate that gradually over time, and then they wanted to signal to the market that, you know, they're going to, you know, have some sort of hostile takeover of it and they're going to run a public campaign to get shareholders to vote on behalf of what they're doing to just liquidate the Bitcoin, they'd have to be very quiet about like not signaling the market. And like the actual execution of it's something that's just like, you know, it's something that billionaires do and it's a hard thing to do. And like, so, you know, we'll see. It could also be something that is just simply an acquisition by one of the other treasury companies. But to really capture the spread from what you're doing, you need to have your position before the market's aware of your position, or you need to have some sort of agreement to like off-market terms that shareholders are voting for. So that just all gets like really complicated from like a governance and execution standpoint. So like that's kind of my caveat with it is we think it's probably going to happen, but we do need to see depressed, discounted valuations of the equity relative to the Bitcoin stack for a period of time, and somebody's actually got to execute on it right. We could have Bitcoin rally in the next month, 40%. And all of a sudden expectations of the market changes. And everybody's like, okay, these Bitcoin treasury companies are going to be, you know, moving into a much easier environment for capital raising now. And maybe some of the treasury companies that haven't been able to issue a form of like credit or a preferred equity structure that allows them to fix their cost of capital, because that's a key variable right? Like if you can't fix your cost of capital, then it's just like a circular machine of equity raising and diluting. So you need to be able to fix some portion of your cost of capital. And there's like only a handful have been able to do that, and nobody else really has. So for the companies, the market might start assuming, okay, now that it's moving back up, I bet these guys who weren't able to do it last year, they're going to do it this year. And then maybe it goes back up to a premium because of that. But I think it's like the price of Bitcoin will need to be low enough, long enough. And I expect that if that were to happen, it would probably happen like early in the year, because I think Bitcoin's going up.
Me too, for what it's worth. Okay, no, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, because obviously the treasury companies, and I was just talking to someone today about this, just this idea that maybe the blow off top was actually in treasury companies. I was talking with Nico on Simply Bitcoin. He was talking to Mauricio Di Bartolomeo about it. And I thought that's actually an interesting thesis, that like we didn't get the same kind of blow off top from retail in Bitcoin because there was a blow off top in equities. I don't know if you have a take on that.
Yeah. So the way I think that it did happen, saying to what degree it happened is another question. But the fact that companies are able to raise capital on a premium to their MNAV and buy Bitcoin with it means that people are paying more potentially per unit of Bitcoin. And like we've kind of witnessed that there was like a bit of, you know, it was a bit of like a dumping on retail effectively through raising on a MNAV premium. So like that's, people got less Bitcoin for their money, and that probably drove less relative demand into Bitcoin, and more of that kind of either went into the pockets or is earmarked for future Bitcoin capital deployment within some of these treasury companies. And you know, I don't know what to say, like which one it was or to what proportion, yeah. But yeah, so like there is theoretical justification that like buying paper Bitcoin that is more expensive than Bitcoin itself did cause less demand for Bitcoin had it all flown through like spot markets.
Right. Now, I thought it was an interesting kind of thesis around that, so I wanted to get your opinion on it. The next point here is number 7. Which is that a Bitcoin company receives conditional approval for a federal bank charter. This would actually be a huge deal. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think this is something that maybe if folks haven't been paying attention, they're not aware of kind of like some of the history here and how some of the just like shenanigans in general. Can you talk about why this would be so kind of impactful?
Yeah. There's a long history, and it kind of depends on, there's a ton of nuance, and with, you know, my operating partner at Epoch, he has a law degree and he does most of our legal research on everything. And if there's one thing I've kind of learned over the past year working with him directly on a lot of these regulatory questions is that things are much grayer. There's a lot of gray area in terms of what could happen and when it could happen and how to interpret the law, et cetera. So I think that like the big thing that we're getting at with this prediction is conditional approval isn't like you're going to get a bank charter. It's a nod that directionally speaking, we want to give you a bank charter and we need to do more work and research and let's move forward on next steps because of it. So it's like what happened last year was there is a Peter Thiel-backed company, Erebor, that is trying to become like a modern bank for tech companies with a federal bank charter. And that receives conditional approval from submission, from the point of submission within about, I think it was like 3 or 4 months. So that was big. That was a really big news. And it's more like we see that there's a lot of Bitcoin companies that are going to start thinking this angle. And it's like, okay, well, if some are reasonably backed with enough capital, then they can pursue something like this. And it makes sense that from the point at which they would submit for a federal bank charter, that they could see a conditional approval for it. And a lot of the history at like front and center was like Caitlin Long fighting the Biden administration to get a Federal Reserve master account. And you know, there's a ton of history and lore around all of that, but it's like, I mean, the whole view I think right now is get while the getting's good, because the current Trump administration is creating a favorable environment for things like this to happen. And I think that really greases the wheels on whether that'll happen within the next year. But I think we're kind of on the edge of it.
Okay. And yeah, that leads into a little bit of a couple other points down the line here, but I will keep going in order just to feed my mild autism here to not jump out of order. So the next one is around stablecoins. I think this is an interesting one. So a stablecoin uses Bitcoin as a reserve asset to pay interest to its holders offshore. And I think that offshore part is probably key because that also feeds into one of the later points there. But can you talk about that a little bit? Is the reason for the offshore because in relation to the Clarity Act not passing, which is a couple points down the list?
Yeah. So I'm a little bit more familiar with like some of the details around it. And like basically we had the Genius Act pass, which was stablecoin specific back in the fall of 2025. And the two key things that I really viewed this as, and this has become, we wrote this banking report deep diving into a lot of this stuff back in the fall. You can find that on our website as well. But now this is, since Brian Armstrong went public on his disagreement with the Clarity Act, that has brought a lot, it's like it kind of illuminated in a lot more people's minds what happened with Genius, et cetera. And really like what Genius did is it just created this regulatory ring fencing for banks. And, you know, there's like public letters that were written. There was like a, and you kind of feel bad because like community banks are like kind of like the good guys, I guess, in the banking world. They're not like the JP Morgans and, you know, bulge bracket type guys that are, you know, run by reptile people, et cetera. So like the Community Banking Association like sent this letter and they're just like, look, like if you allow stablecoins to get a Fed master account, then our business is done. So don't do that. And that was kind of like this regulatory ring fence. It is an example of like their internal thinking of this is a better technology and creative destruction from it's going to put us out of business. And we finance so much of your political campaigns, like, you know, you owe us and we're going to give you more if you keep it this way. So there's that conflict of interest that I think is driving a lot of it. But like Genius said, stablecoins are not allowed to pay interest to their holders and they have to hold like short duration government treasury assets as reserves and nothing else. And one of like the areas that Clarity from that wanted to provide clarity on is so, like if you look at a company like Circle, that has USDC as their stablecoin they're issuing. Circle isn't even like a company. They're just like, they're like Coinbase's little bitch, basically. Like that's the best way to think about them. And and they really just do all the boring stuff so that Coinbase can then be like, okay, Circle is going to have this stablecoin. It's not going to pay interest on it, but we can pay interest on the stablecoin and we can have that pass. And like that's kind of how the market was planning on structuring everything, is the exchanges are going to end up distributing it through their own interest. So it's like, and it's if you read the regulatory section of this report, which is one of the best sections, particularly for people that are a lot deeper into this industry, my operating partner Vijay wrote it. He's a brilliant guy, and he goes into these details. But we have this little graphic where we basically took when we wrote our banking report last fall, we had, you know, we start the report talking about our banking system structured as a two-tier banking system. And, you know, that's the conventional way that people think about having a central bank that is pushing reserves into the banking system. Then you have regional banks that are also plugged into the banks that have Fed master accounts that are plugged into the Federal Reserve. And it's this like multi-tiered system that allows money to like kind of get pushed through all of it. We like took this graphic and we're like, okay, so if we have this two-tier banking system and you think about how the distribution of money works through it today, and then you say, oh, well, crypto is like this new future. And it's like, really what Coinbase is trying to create is at the top, you have the central bank, and then that's tier one. And then tier two is you have all of the commercial banks that plug into it with a Fed master account. And we like scratch out central bank at the top and write Circle. And then in tier two banks, you scratch out like bank A, we put in Coinbase. And it's like, all they're doing is taking stablecoins and recreating a multi-tiered structure that's arbitrarily intermediated because of some form of regulation within the system. So, and it's like, welcome to the future. And like, we kind of are facetious in the graphic about it, but it's just like, we are very directly kind of recreating it because of arbitrary regulation. And yeah, so I think like, that's kind of like the background on what I guess is like really happening with all of this. And then it like came into question around the confidence of like, okay, well, you know, are these things going to pass, et cetera, but like not going into any of that. You know, I think that like the way that, we're viewing this is like, and we wrote about this in the banking paper is, you know, everybody knows that stablecoins are better. Like that's like the elephant in the room with everybody. And everybody knows that the bank lobby is preventing this from happening. And the question's like, okay, well, if it doesn't happen in the US, then where is it going to happen? And I think that's like when Saylor was hitting home on his stretch product and he's, you know, down in Abu Dhabi and he's telling all the sheiks, he's like, hey, like, somebody should do this. And if you want to lead the world, like there's a huge, huge opportunity here. And we like, we completely agree that like the concept of using Bitcoin as reserve capital, to have an interest bearing product that's lower risk for people. It's a very marginal way of getting more people into the industry. And like Stretch is like this proof of concept that's kind of proving it out, but it's limited, right? Because Stretch exists within a brokerage account. Now, there's a reason for that, and there's a reason it was very successful to do that. But like a stablecoin is something that has a lot more utility than just an account that sits in your brokerage account. And like that big idea of like, okay, well, if I am a stablecoin company, if I'm Tether and I have X amount of reserves that are in treasuries and I earn, you know, 4 or 5% on that, and I could pass some of that along to people. And like if Tether just owned treasury securities and did that, now we're talking about like what banks should be doing. Now we're talking about, right, you know, like that's what a bank should be. That would be a healthy banking system where you actually got like 3 or 4% from your money that you have in the bank. But that's not what they're doing. They actually have like, you know, other, you know, reserve assets in there. And like, we definitely see a world where like Bitcoin is going to move into the capital markets through the reserves of other products that are meeting people where they're at today. And that's what Saylor did, is he took it to the other extreme very immediately. And he said, no, let's just like put way too much Bitcoin backing some sort of product that's paying interest. And it's very easy for us to do that. And now we have a product that everybody wants because it's very low risk and it's paying a higher yield. And that's the belief. It's just like, okay, so if Bitcoin is going to grow at whatever, you know, 30, 40, 50% compound annual growth rate every year, and you can guarantee people's 10% yield over time from having a reserve construction that supports that, now we're talking about a systematically superior form of savings to a treasury security, to which, you know, Bitcoiners would respond, well, why wouldn't you just own Bitcoin directly? It's like, well, because people are too stupid to own Bitcoin directly. they need this. You know, you have to like, if you want to feed your dog, you know, some sort of like healthy thing, you got to like wrap it in a treat that it is familiar with. And like, that's literally what we're doing. We're like force feeding Bitcoin through financial products that people are familiar with. So like, that's kind of our prediction around that, is the US regulatory environment doesn't provide the ability to really do this effectively. And it's going to emerge somewhere else in the world. And Tether doesn't, because Tether is so dominant, doesn't necessarily have an incentive to do it yet. They just get to pocket all the money. Good for them. I hope they invest in us one day. But at some point they probably will, as the competitive environment starts to emerge.
I love that analogy with the dog. That's
yeah, rock, it just came to me. So I haven't used that yet. Yeah.
No, it's good. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Like, that's the reality too. And I think we talk about this as Bitcoiners a lot. It may not always be the most popular viewpoint, but it's like most people aren't going to do self-custody Bitcoin. Like,
yeah.
It's just, you know, I'm not saying that that's a good thing. I'm just saying that that's the reality. Like, and they don't necessarily need to. Like, that can be for us. Like, I'm going to keep doing it. You're going to keep doing it. A lot of us are going to keep doing it, and a lot more people will do it. But to think that, like, you know, the majority of people are going to do that, I don't know. Like, I don't even think it matters how easy you make that process.
Yeah.
I think still just most people don't want to have that kind of radical ownership and responsibility for what that also implies. You know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah, I agree. And like, the framework that I've kind of written about in the past around it is just like the when people participate in something when like the marginal cost of participation hits some sort of threshold relative to its benefit. It's like there are certain things that people have spent a lot of time getting good at or learning or, you know, becoming part of their life because of how they view the benefit of it. happening. So like personal computing, for people to learn how to, you know, type on keyboards, how to operate in a computing system. Like there's so much education we all have. And, you know, and like our generation have had since a young age to be able to do that well. And that was because participating in the internet was such a valuable thing. I think that the reality is today for the vast majority of people, it just doesn't matter as much. But what I think it like they don't see the reasons to do it because they don't know, or they aren't, you know, being tracked by the FBI, or being, you know, they're just not even aware of it. And like, so it's just like, but who is going to do it? And I think when you think, if you think about it in terms of like the volume of people, it's going to be a lot less in the near term. But what I think when you think about it in terms of the volume of capital, self-custody is actually going to be a lot higher, because people who have a lot of money spend a lot of time thinking about these things. How do I keep control over it? How do I keep it private? And I think that, you know, when Bitcoin's a $20 trillion asset class, the proportion of actual capital of it that will be held in like a self-custodial private manner at that point, especially when we have much like simpler tools, I think that that's going to end up being a lot higher than people expect. I think nation states are going to want to control it for themselves. It makes sense to pay for an in-house operations team to manage that through. And you can see a lot of other large scale institutions where they stand to gain quite a bit from actually learning and bringing these things in internally for their own control.
I agree with that. And I think it's actually a good point that like the people who are power users aren't necessarily just going to be individuals, right?
Right.
People who really want to benefit from the radical properties that Bitcoin has in terms of its like truly being unconfiscatable private property. Like,
right.
That's going to especially be people who have a lot of, you know, property that they want to keep to themselves. Right.
Exactly.
So I think that makes perfect sense.
It's like, you know, Swiss bank accounts are viewed as this luxury because and it's right. like something that like fancy rich people do, you know, and that's kind of it's the idea of a Swiss bank account. And like, and that was because it provided them certain properties. They were the power users that were like, okay, well, I want to have as much anonymity and control over my assets without, you know, whatever risks that could be occurring for people trying to control my assets. And I think a similar thing is going to end up happening with Bitcoin.
So I want to keep moving down this list here because there are a bunch of really good ones to get to. Some of them we sort of covered already a little bit, but one that we haven't, you were mentioning Tether a little bit, and they're obviously working with Jack Mallers with 21 Capital. Your number 9 prediction is 21 Capital acquires Strike. Do you think that happens? Does Strike go public before that? Or do you think that's part, like I can see that happening, but I want to know, does Strike go public first?
I hadn't thought about that. I don't see why. I think they should buy it. And because Jack, I just, from what I've seen Jack say publicly on 21, it's just like, oh, okay, yeah, he's going to buy Strike. It would make a ton of sense for them to do it. Like one of the things that we wrote about a bit more in depth in our report from last year, not our annual report from this year, was just like the fundamental reasons for what is like good or strategic for a treasury company. And one of the big things we wrote about is like treasury companies that are like, okay, we want to build out an operating business. And it's like, okay, well, what business? What an operating business is just any sort of business, right? So it's anything other than managing assets, really. And do you want to make ice cream? Like, do you want to open up a pet shop? Like, there's a million things that you could do. How do you choose what's the best one? And I think that the best way to think about it is, well, what business, what type of business needs Bitcoin? Because you're already something that has a lot of Bitcoin. So what type of business needs Bitcoin more so than others? And that's mostly a financial service business that requires liquidity. Because what they have to do today when they don't have a lot of Bitcoin, and they say, okay, well, we need some other person who has a lot of Bitcoin to fulfill that. And oh, that other person's going to charge us X percent fee to say, like, one of our customers wants to, you know, move $1 million cross border in Bitcoin. And we'll say, okay, that customer just wired to a bank account that the company controls $1 million. And then what we're going to do is we're going to swap it for Bitcoin. So we need some sort of liquidity provider who's going to come in and give the Bitcoin, send that Bitcoin going to another country where the remittance payment's going. And then on the other end, somebody's got to say, okay, we'll buy that Bitcoin back, swap it into a bank account at the other end, and then you get the foreign currency or the domestic currency in the foreign country on the other end. So you have like these different components of people that are providing Bitcoin liquidity within a lot of financial service businesses. And that's just like one example for a remittance payment company. And, you know, Strike does things like that. And I'm sure that they could do quite a bit of other things. And I think that that seems like a very natural thing, obviously, with Jack being at the head of both, which would be sweet. I think that that would be really good for our industry, too, particularly for us being in venture capital, because it shows that there's value, and we'll see just like what the value is of a lot of these Bitcoin businesses. Because those are very young. We have a whole like venture capital section going into like Bitcoin businesses and what that kind of means. And I think one of the interesting things is like there's actually a lot more like financing and crypto businesses that started a long time ago. And the Bitcoin ones are all like much younger. So like right now it's kind of like the value of these businesses is still being proven out. Most of them emerged like 2021 and onward. And so I think it'd be really cool for the industry too. And we're being a bit like kind of like calling it out directly was just kind of like a fun thing. But I see it happening.
I like it. You're kind of forcing the hand a little bit, right?
Just yeah, making yourself a do it, Jack. Prophecy. Do it.
Yeah. Do it. Well, okay. So the next couple points here, we've sort of touched on them already. So maybe we can just we'll just go over them lightly, but it's point 10 and point 11. The first one is the Clarity Act does not pass, but even if it does pass, it's not going to be the end of the fight over stablecoin yield. And 11 is then the substance of the Clarity Act, which is asset taxonomy and allocating authority to the SEC and CFTC, will be accomplished via SEC rulemaking and guidance in 2026. So, I mean, you touched on this a little bit already, but this is basically saying, I mean, even if it does go through, like, most of any meaningful kind of movements here are going to be done just by SEC rulemaking at the end of the day anyway?
Yeah, that's kind of what he's getting at. And like my these two predictions are from like our regulatory section that VJ wrote. And but yeah, that's the gist of it, is that a lot of these things can be accomplished via other regulatory bodies. And there's just so much gray area within all of this.
Yeah, we don't have to dig into those two duplicates. We did kind of cover them already. And I do want to get to the next one, which is a juicier, verging into the political realm a little bit more here, which is that Republicans, this is point number 12, Republicans will lose the midterms and there will be meaningful anti-crypto regulation or regulatory blowback, most likely in the form of consumer protection. So, I mean, this is something that we've all been kind of talking about, too. It's like, okay, yeah, the Trump administration is favorable towards Bitcoin and crypto, very favorable towards crypto, as we all know. But obviously, the pendulum swings back, right? So yeah. Is this basically, you think this is going to be primarily just a kind of reactionary thing for the left to sort of distance themselves from what they see as sort of the, let's say, the impropriety of the Trump administration's stance on Bitcoin and, quote, crypto?
Can I call VJ right now and have him answer that? I think he'll have a really good answer for it.
Sure, why
just like
not?
Plug it into the mic. Yeah, okay.
I love it. I've never had a live phone a friend on the show before. This is the Bitcoin Podcast First. I love it. It's going to be super awkward if he
doesn't
answer.
Yeah, I know. He shouldn't be on a call. Come on.
Oh man, the suspense
Damn,
is killing me.
I don't know. Okay, let me message him and see. But so like that's pretty much how we're viewing it. But I think here he's calling back. Here we go.
Amazing,
VJ. I'm on a podcast right now. We're live and we're going through the predictions of that you put into the report. And we just got into the Republicans losing the midterms and all of that one. So I've got you on the mic. Give the 101 on what you're thinking with that.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess the them losing the midterms, I think, is probably, you know, driven by non-Bitcoin crypto-related things, but just you can see their popularity slipping. I guess the only hedge on that is like Democrat popularity doesn't seem to be picking up in tandem, but you know, there's so much chaos. It feels like, that you know, at the very least, losing the size of their majority or their kind of dominant sway at the moment. And I think the likelihood, I guess the main prediction we had in there around this was that there would be some kind of backlash against, you know, the Bitcoin crypto voters that I think some of the Democratic Party sees as part of the Trump coalition. And I think, you know, some of the Trump administration's activities since he's been inaugurated haven't really helped in that regard. I think some of the, you know, Trump coin scammier seeming stuff, I think will invites back in a lot of skepticism and potential, you know, regulatory scrutiny that we may have moved beyond as an industry. I think the mitigating factor will be that a lot of the right now folks that Trump has installed in the agencies and the kind of administrative strategy of most of the enforcement arms of the government has shifted to a more positive one. I think that will be hard to pivot, but I suspect at least like in Congress, you know, as we have a new class of representatives and senators coming in after the midterms, I think at the very least, the kind of pro Bitcoin, pro crypto momentum will stall. And there's likely to be, I don't know who or what will be leading the charge, but I suspect, you know, some kind of backlash, probably from the consumer protection angle, which seems to be the flag that some of the Democrats that are a little more opposed to the Clarity Act are carrying right now, which would involve, you know, in trying to impose a lot more scrutiny on and obligations on people building self-custody stuff, or like ATM providers, that kind of stuff, where, you know, there's existing consumer protections regulations that impose a lot of costs on those kinds of businesses that I think Bitcoin has rightly avoided because of the non-custodial nature of a lot of those products. I think there'll be a stronger push from the Democrats to come in to try to, you know, impose some of those regulations on that part of the industry.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
that was awesome, man. Thanks for jumping in. We've never done this before on the show, so this was great.
All right. Thanks, VJ.
Yeah, of course.
Later.
All right, talk
that was a very successful phone a friend, I've got to say.
Yeah, that worked. That worked.
Very impressed there. Okay, well, okay, that covered that one super well. And I want to be conscious of your time too, so we're going to go through some of the next ones a little bit quickly here. But the next one I think is one that definitely bears jumping into, which is just the Samurai Wallet Tornado Cash Founders is point number 13. They will not be pardoned this year, but there will be likely be future criminal cases or appeals that vindicate them. So you don't think there's much of a chance of the Trump admin actually stepping forward to give pardons?
Yeah, this is also VJ's perspective, but yeah, it's probably something that will take more critical mass around it is kind of the expectations, and that over time, more things will happen that will ultimately lead to an outcome similar to that, whether it's not them in like the immediate term.
Well, in the meantime, people should go to billandkeone.org and do sign that petition and continue making noise on social media, because you never know what might move the needle. And again, that is billandkeone.org. Point number 14, BitChat goes mainstream for local P2P discovery, driving over 200 known eCash mints. You touched on this a bit earlier at the start, and I think the eCash proliferation is such a key point to this. Is there anything else you wanted to add to that based on?
Right now there's around like 30 on Cashew, and then through Fedimint, I think it's like 16 or something, because those are larger. But like that's the way it works. And it could be a lot more, you know. I didn't really know how to put like a number, but I was like, yeah, like 200. Yeah. That's a lot of growth. But yeah, to the point I was making earlier about like the P2P discovery and all of that, I think it's a valuable app. You know, our office is at the Space Denver, our Bitcoin Citadel out here, and you know, we'll just be like chatting with each other on it a lot of times in the middle of the day. And like, I see a lot more use cases like at concerts or like anywhere you go publicly where it makes sense to like figure out some information that can be crowdsourced within a group in your immediate region. Like, I see it being used a lot more for that once it gets more eyeballs on it.
100%. The next one here, and apologies for the speed fire, but again, I like to be conscious of the time.
Yeah.
At least 100, this is point number 15, at least 100 small businesses begin offering discounts for payment in Bitcoin instead of dollars through Square. I mean, we've got, 4 million plus merchants that just got the ability to be turned online. I mean, that was one of the, I think, the most bullish developments this year. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I think that the Square announcement is arguably the best thing that's happened for medium exchange use of Bitcoin, like, in its history, outside of it existing. But, I think that, yeah, it getting turned on within this it's going to change, one, just, like, even from a branding perspective, it's going to change people's perception of it significantly. But, like, the biggest thing is, one of the things that I always try to hit home is that when, you know, for Bitcoin being used as a medium exchange, and people be like, well, nobody's ever going to want to spend their own Bitcoin. It's just like, dude, I don't want to spend anything that's valuable to me. If I could get something from you and give you my toilet paper, I would be happy to, you know, but nobody's going to want that. It comes from people demanding it in a transaction. People are going to say, no, I want you to pay me in Bitcoin. And I think that that's where we're going to start seeing a lot of growth through this vector within Square. And the reason isn't as much because people are like, I own a scarce, durable, portable store of value that I can be self-sovereign with. It's going to be because, oh, these are better rails than, you know, the encroachment of the banking industry, which makes it so expensive for anybody to operate within it. So credit card companies have to create a layer over it, and then they have to charge X amount of fees because it's an oligopolistic network as well. And all the merchants are the ones paying for that right now. We don't want to do that. We would like to settle over something cheaper. Okay, so Square has designed a system where we don't get a 2.5% credit card fee. All right, well, let's offer people a discount to pay in Bitcoin. That's 2.5% that goes to our margin. Bottom line, every year, you know, you make $1 million through your business in profit every year, tack another 2.5% on it. Like, that's a lot of money. People are going to want that. And I think stores are going to start incentivizing Bitcoin so that they can keep some of that.
Yeah, I think especially in lower margin businesses where those fees really hit them like right in the gut, we're absolutely going to see that. And I think, again, just super bullish announcement. I would agree. It's just like it was massive news this year that, again, just like didn't apparently move the needle price wise, but like very much moved the needle, I think, overall MOE adoption wise, which was great.
Yep.
The next point, 16, no top 10 public Bitcoin mining company achieves more than 30% of revenue from AI compute for 2026 fiscal year, driven by significant development delays. So this is an interesting one, given a lot of the pivots toward AI compute in a lot of these mining companies. You're saying that, I'm not sure what, you know, kind of some of the numbers are right now in terms of percentage of revenue, but you're saying basically it won't go above 30% for any of these.
Yeah,
predominantly miners.
That was the biggest surprise to me when I looked into this question, because I was writing this section in our business models, and I was like, okay, I wonder how big these mining pivots have been so far. And I started to look at the publicly available numbers that we could see, and I assumed they would be much larger. Why? All these guys want to have that premium in their stock price because of how much it's being valued right now. So the narratives say we're an AI compute company. The reality is that I think the largest in terms of like operating AI compute revenue generation, that's Core Scientific, and they're at like 18% right now. And most of the other ones, I'm pretty sure, are all like sub 10%. There's a table in our report that covers all of that. I bet in 20, like, I think the problem is there's a lot of assets that exist out there to build more AI compute and repurpose some of these operations for it. But there is a lot of development delays that are starting to occur within this side of the industry, and actually being able to build out, get these sites developed or get them repurposed and operating and generating revenue. I don't think that anybody's going to get higher than 30% of their total, annualized revenue for 2026. Maybe that's a bit of a cocky estimate, I'd say. But probably somewhere around that range. I would be surprised if they get much higher than that.
No, it's interesting. I assumed that some of them were already higher than that. So that's quite interesting given the amount of hype around it.
Yeah.
So next piece, number 17, a federally chartered bank begins offering Bitcoin collateralized loans. Do you think that this ends up being a bank that kind of like acquires one of the existing companies that it's doing this in the space, or building out their own products around this?
That's a great question. So in our banking report back in the fall, we hit on this. If you look at banks, what are banks? Banks are really just like, when you think about it from like a business, like legal entity standpoint, they're really just this like compliance apparatus. Like you have just like this company that does this, and everything that they do is technically like outsourced in most ways, in some way, shape or form. And they, you know, we have this core ledger system that we're using for, you know, managing our ledger internally within the bank. And that's kind of being outsourced to this like tech company that does that for a lot of different banks. And, you know, we have like a payments hub, and it's a very similar story to how they're using their core ledger system. Any sort of functionality that they're doing, they either have like a third party service provider, or they're acquiring into it from some like separate division. So it might be like owned by them, but it's really like a very separate thing from like the overarching bank. And yeah, so I think like the history of banking is, if banks want to do something, they acquire into it, right. Broadly speaking. Like they don't have the expertise to build a lot of this stuff out. Now, I think that we will have banks that, which are kind of starting off as like the, we have this new, like the term we use for it internally at Epoch is neo-neobanks. The term neobank kind of came around when fintech was like, okay, banks suck, let's put a layer of lipstick over it so people have a better UX for everything and integrate into some more things. And then now we have this world of like, okay, fintechs kind of suck, let's give them stable coins and Bitcoin and hook them into prediction markets and like do all this other shit that like the neo version wants to do. So that's kind of what we call it. There's going to be like these very new financial institutions that are going to be like purpose built for Bitcoin banking. And those will probably be, you know, those will be more organic in building things in house. And then maybe they're actually selling some of what they built to the other banks. But yeah, I think that if it's a larger bank in this prediction adopting something like that, there's it's hard to do everything because there's a lot of software that needs to get built to make it easy for them. And the reason is to my point earlier, banks operate on like this old legacy technology with like an old core ledger system and an old payments hub. And like, you have the CTOs just like, I don't really care how cool the new thing is that you have. I'm not going to convert our entire bank over a new set of software. Like, you need to have something that plugs into this shitty old software. And that's kind of what they need right now, are businesses that are building the right middleware that speaks the same language of what they work on, what they use internally. And there's a pretty big void in that market right now. So we kind of wrote our banking report around that thesis with like the Silvergate, former Silvergate banking team. And yeah, I think that, you know, those things are going to get built. And then it comes down to a regulatory question as to how like big that can get within a bank's like total revenue, et cetera.
Now, it's going to be interesting to see. 18, and I'm going to speed run here again, but quantum preparedness continues to happen around trade-offs among various key and signature schemes. Code is written for BIP360, but no concrete soft fork is in the works by the end of 2026. Do you think a lot of the quantum stuff is being, how much of an immediate concern do you think this is? I see a lot of stuff around it, but then it's also like a lot of the conversation around it that's FUDing quantum stuff a lot seems to ignore all the conversations that are happening already. Yep. And kind of being like, hey, we need to do this right now. Also, I've got a quantum resistant, you know, shitcoin on Solana, by the way, or Ethereum. You know what I mean? Like, is that your vibe on this too?
Yeah, there was just like a weird, I like what I'll say is I like what Nick Carter did. I think he drew attention to things that educated me, educated other people in the industry. And I, you know, I don't know if he responded to everything in the perfect way on Twitter. And you know, few people always do, but, I do think his paper was a good paper and it added value. I'm in the camp of just like, well, one, I'll start with saying, I wrote this quantum section in the report, and that's probably been like the most like clipped and shared thing from it so far. That's not my intelligence. That's the intelligence of me interpreting other people's interpretations of quantum. I think Reared in Code is probably the best podcast I've heard on the quantum summary. Hunter Beast is who's writing BIP360 and started all that. He's a member at the space. I talk to him a lot. I think that like the quantum is something where I'm at is like, it's a legitimate conversation to be having. And to your point, exactly, people have been having this conversation. If you don't read it, Bitcoin OpTech, which very few people do, particularly the types of people that are commenting on Quantum and the type of investors I talk to. But like Bitcoin OpTech gave a great summary of a lot of the progress in their annual report a few months ago on what's been happening within Quantum. There's a good amount of research. I'm not trying to put people down for wanting to have a discussion and try to, you know, put focus on something that's valuable. But what we wrote about in our media section of the report is that, like, when you look at how certain narratives spread for FUD, usually it's like they start within mainstream media and then they like trickle down into our circles and then we have to like go combat them. And like one thing in that section is where like we officially have destroyed environmental FUD. And that took like 3 years of data intensive, systematic, cooperative Bitcoiners like coming together and shitting on that FUD, and it's dead now and we won. And it ended up being one of the best narratives for Bitcoin too that came out of it. So that's cool. But with like the Quantum stuff, we kind of FUD ourselves and then it gets in because of us. So we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot a bit. And it's like, maybe let the nerds talk about it for a little bit longer. And until it really becomes something to get worried about, like just let them handle it in their forums that other people aren't ever reading.
Fair enough on that one. 19, Bitcoin perception gap closes 50%. Oh, what does that mean?
Yeah. So read the Bitcoin media section. The perception metrics are like, they're really cool. Fernando of perception.to is his website, but he's come up with just like a methodology of like putting a point system and quantification around narratives from different media channels. And the perception gap is something that is that gap I was initially talking about between how Bitcoiners perceive Bitcoin and how like mainstream perceives Bitcoin. And he quantifies that as like a 125 point gap, which is like very large when you start to get baselined and see how that's compared across other things. But I think that over this year, we're going to start to see a lot more alignment across both. I feel like I've kind of witnessed that over the past year. And I'm excited to see how he measures it going into next year and what the numbers come out to. But I think that we're going to start to see cross-pollination across media channels. Bitcoin's moving into like more of the 4A and the big boy world. And I think that that gap is not going to exist to the same extremes that it has.
Bitcoin podcasts go absolutely parabolic.
Yes.
As we completely subsume the TradFi market.
So bullish.
People should check out the media section for that on the report. Number 20, Bitcoin Core maintains dominance over alternative implementations. Is there anything you'd like to say on that one?
No, I think that says it all. That's
and just like that, we're out of time. last one, I want to give you a chance to talk about this too, and then I will get you out of here. But Epoch Ventures begins raising its fund too. So you guys are raising, yeah?
Yeah, not yet, but we're predicting that we might be by the end of the year. So.
Okay. It's like an announcement of an announcement, but it's a prediction.
It's a prediction of an announcement.
Well, dude, I'm getting you out of here a little bit late. Where do you, again, maybe just remind people where they can go to get this report, anywhere else you want to send them. Appreciate you running through this whole thing. This was an awesome session here.
Yeah, this was great, man. If you want to check out the report, it's Epoch, EPOCHVC.io. That's our website. Go to the writing section. It's in there as a PDF to download. We don't do like an email or anything ask on it because that shit always annoyed me and I don't ever want to do that to people. So just download the PDF and do something nice for me one day. But or people on my team, they're all tagged in it. And check us out on Twitter. You'll see all of our handles in the report and my handle on X is just my name.
Awesome, dude. Well, this was a blast doing this. We made it through all 21 predictions. Can't imagine why you chose the number 21. Seems super random. But this was great. Want people to check this report out because it is dense, but it's dense in a good way.
She's a beast.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, dude, Eric, great catching up with you, man. We'll have to do this again. Next time I won't nail you with 21 questions right off the bat. I will keep it, you know, we'll do a question halving or something like that.
Yeah. We'll do more of like a vibes episode at some point.
Yeah. If I didn't go through this with you, I would have felt like I was missing out. You know, we had to give the people these 21.
Right. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. It was a blast.
Likewise, man.